Hello everyone, this is Mike Quinsey, Connecting the Light. My guest today is Michael Gellert, who has just issued a new book, The Way of the Small, Why Less is Truly More, which has been described as a practical and spiritual guide for complex times. Are you there, Michael?
Yes, I am. I'm here.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
I think we should first ask you what it was that prompted you to write this book.
Well, I had a series of experiences in the period around 9/11. I had to go for brain surgery because I had a tumor. And then I went through some personal changes in my private life. I had a divorce. I had some other difficulties that one came on top of the other. And I found myself falling into a depression where I felt my life was insignificant, and I felt that I had failed in many areas. And what I experienced after a long period of struggle was that instead of running away from these diminishing ordeals, by turning around and facing them and embracing them, I actually found that the situation transformed. And I discovered that one can be content and find fulfillment even in the midst of such suffering.
Yes.
So that led me to write a book about the value of being small, living small, and embracing such diminishing ordeals.
Right. So what was the spiritual guidance that is referred to that your book gives people? Because I feel that's very interesting, because I think in life at the moment, spirituality amongst people is perhaps sadly lacking. So I'm interested to know, what is the nature of your spiritual guidance?
Well, experiences like what I just described that happened to me, excuse me,
yes,
are nothing new. People go through them. Everybody goes through some variation of loss and suffering in their lives, and people have been experiencing that since the beginning of time. I found that actually all our world religions, in their most practical teachings, espouse this principle of being small, of living small, of accepting our limits and living within our means. I did an inquiry into all the different great traditions, and I found that all of them teach this principle. So one can easily find a lot of spiritual support, whatever religion they're in their own tradition. In Christianity, Jesus was a master of the small. Many of his parables speak to the value of this principle. Lest ye be like little children, ye shall not find the kingdom of God. Heaven begins as a mustard seed and grows from there, the kingdom of God. The least among you shall find it. His whole life was a paradigm for smallness. So you find this in every tradition in its own way. And then, of course, people must find this within themselves, not just, in the scriptures. Everything in our psyche points to the value of not being inflated. If we listen to our dreams carefully, if we watch our experiences, usually when we get too inflated, too big for our shoes, get too ambitious, we want too much, we tax our resources, we get exhausted, we overeat. All the things we do that feed our impulse to gratify ourselves by becoming more or getting more often lead to the exact opposite of what we're searching for. They don't lead to happiness, but unhappiness.
Yeah. Now, you have the advantage, obviously, as you've just said, of investigating these different religions with your ideas in mind. Looking at it from a point of view of what practical steps people can take, are you actually referring them to religion, or are you intimating that through that you can take out, if you like, the best advice?
Both, in a way. I don't. I'm a psychotherapist, so I don't teach a particular religion. Somebody comes to me, and they are a practicing Christian or a Jew or a Muslim or a Buddhist. I may mention to them that they could find much help for their everyday problems within their own tradition. But what I do is, and what I've done in this book, is I've extracted the essential teachings from these traditions and explain them in a modern, accessible way for people that they could practice it in the context of whatever dilemma they're going through, whatever their particular situation is. Often I will ask people to write down three paragraphs, and I give this exercise in the book through an illustration, three paragraphs, one on where, what living small or being small would look like in their professional or business life. Two, what living small or being small would look like in their relationships, in their family, in their marriage, with their children. And three, what living small or being small would look like spiritually in their spiritual or creative life.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting that when people do that, they can discover for themselves where in their lives some attitude needs to be shifted, and there, all the different principles for living small can be applied. And of course, in the book, I go through a number of those as well.
Yeah. Now, I think you've said in the book, or a review said, that happiness is found in the small. How would you exactly describe what the small is? I know you've touched upon it already, but it's in your title, seems to be an important aspect.
Well, there's a tendency in human nature to always look for happiness on the other side of the hill. The grass is always greener over there.
Yes.
We want more than what we have. We want something different than what we have. Regardless of how much somebody has, there's a gene in our nature that seems to always search for more. What I suggest is that by inhibiting that impulse and taking a look at what life has immediately put on the table in front of one, one can find almost all the time everything they need there to find some spiritual fulfillment or happiness. What does one really need to be happy? That's another thing people could sit down and think about and maybe write a little bit about. What is it more that they feel they need to get that they don't have? Yeah. Most of the things in life, if we take a good look at our history of positive experiences, it's the little things that make us happy, the little joys, special moments with our loved ones, special feelings of accomplishment if we've done some good gardening in the backyard, or done a painting that we like, or gone to a museum or a film that was rewarding, or played a game of backgammon with our kids. Great masters of the small in history are many, and all of them, although they attained greatness in their lives, usually found their fulfillment and their key to success through small steps, small measures. If you take a look at America's great master of the small, Henry David Thoreau, he went off to Walden and spent his time looking at all the small workings of nature. And he observed and enjoyed the changes of the season, the activities of the insects and the little creatures, and he just studied that. And out of focus on those small details, he discovered the miraculous wonders of nature.
Yes.
Mother Teresa is another example.
Yes.
Winston Churchill was a man who obviously had great challenges before him, but he also had an uncanny ability to appreciate small things. He understood that small precision on the small details bring success. That's how he masterminded his prime ministership, and I talk about that in the book. But he also enjoyed painting. He had special moments with his family and his wife. He was an ordinary person. So what I mean by the small here, or living small, or being small, is not what this means in popular language. It doesn't mean to be small-minded or petty or to be disempowered. It means to live within our means, to live within our skin, to inhabit our humanity with its limits, and to appreciate the little things of life, because most happiness comes from those.
Yes, yes. Well, funnily enough, I was going to ask you on that very point, because I read that the book covers celebrating, I'm quoting out here, the details of everyday life and living wisely within the limits, which of course is what you've just said. Can you give us an example of what you would feel would be a wise way to limit some of the things we do in life?
Well, I suppose at this time of the year, there's a, at least in America, where we're extremely consumer-driven, there's a pressure on people to celebrate these holidays in a very grandiose way. People feel they've got to get bigger and better gifts for everybody, and they've got to get bigger and better gifts to feel that they've had a rewarding Christmas. There's also a pressure to party a lot and to be very social.
Yeah.
What most psychotherapists find is that the month of January is one of the busiest months in the year. And why is that? Because this inflated grand drive toward a very demonstrative way of celebrating a simple holiday leads to a lot of disappointment,
yeah,
failure of expectations, stress, family conflicts, and people get very depressed and end up coming right after the holidays to the psychotherapist to get help. There's a simple way right now that people can ask themselves, what is the true spirit and intent of the holiday, to size down their expectations and to be a little more modest, to be actually a little more in the spirit of Jesus. I don't know if this orientation we have really delivers what we believe it will. That orientation is there all the time, Mike. It's not just in the holidays. It's there throughout the year. It's there not just in our personal lives. It's there socially. It's there in our international relations. The impulse to be bigger than we are and to strive to be godlike, this is something in human nature. And the opposite instinct or tendency, which is to be modest and humble and to live within our limits, this is what needs to come in as a way to check that,
yeah,
other impulse.
Right. So that really fits in with the comment that your book teaches the joys of simplicity and modesty. Would you like to add anything on that particular point?
Well, you know, simplicity and modesty needs to be an organic experience that is tailored to the individual. People have a fixed idea of what it means to be modest or humble or simple. For example, they think that by following somebody like Gandhi, who was a great master of the small, they will,
yeah,
be simple and modest. But, you know, not all of us are cut out to be a Gandhi, to be saint-like, to live a life of renunciation and austerity. Somebody once said that humility is to make a right estimate of oneself.
Yeah.
So really what it means to be humble and simple is to be true to yourself. If you're somebody who likes to do certain things that to somebody else might not be their idea of simplicity and modesty, but for you it's a simple way of enjoying yourself, and it's not harmful, well, it has to be something that suits your own nature. So this is not about following a formula. It's about everybody finding their own particular path to what smallness would mean in their particular lives.
Yeah. Now, you talk of embracing life's diminishing ordeals, such as failure, illness, and the loss of a loved one, or aging. Now, I would think out of all those, perhaps the loss of a loved one would be one of the most critical times in a person's life. How would you suggest they embrace that particular situation in light of what you've written in your book?
Well, when somebody comes to my office having lost somebody they loved, I encourage them to embrace this difficult experience and work with it in a very small and slow way. People often want to get out of their grief and get over their loss. I've seen a number of instances somebody loses a spouse and they want to start dating just 2 or 3 months after, even though they're depressed. It's a way of coping or compensating, but it's actually an escape. I encourage people to fully inhabit their grief, not get overwhelmed with it so that they can't function, but to really allow themselves to go through the loss and the pain. The Talmud, the Jewish Talmud, teaches that when we lose somebody we love, we should give ourselves a year of mourning. Why a year? Because in a year we're going to go through the four seasons, and we're going to live through within each season all the memories we had with that loved one we lost in that season. And if in that year people are asking us if we want to go out for a dinner or to a movie or to a party and we don't feel like it because we're in grief, during that year of grieving, it's appropriate to say, no, I need to be small, I need to suffer my loss, I need to inhabit my suffering. At the end of the year, that grief period needs to be formally over. Now, it doesn't mean we stop missing the person we lost. It doesn't mean that we don't have sadness in our heart when we miss them. But it means that we have stepped back into life, that we're no longer living under the shadow of that, so that we don't end up living in the land of the dead, so to speak.
Yeah.
So you see, that kind of a teaching, it gives permission for you to really fully have your loss. That is the only way you can really work it through and live with it. The idea is not to get over the loss, it's to learn to live with it.
Yeah. Now, you've gone deeply into the different religions, and I guess they all teach that death is not the end of life, simply some type of transformation. I would think that for someone who's lost a loved one, to know that somewhere in the future, through some way or means, that they may meet that soul again, would be very uplifting. Does that type of guidance come into your teachings or the way you get people to think about it?
Well, of course, the hope or desire that we will reunite with our loved ones is universal. It's been there since the beginning of human consciousness, and it's at the heart of many of our religions.
Yeah.
It's a mystery. I don't think anybody knows for sure what will come after we die. Clearly, people that I've worked with often have dreams of loved ones who have passed coming and visiting them and talking to them or giving them some sort of solace or advice. whether the dream world attaches in some, or is connected in some mysterious way to the beyond, I suppose is a matter of personal belief. I encourage people to be open to these things because it is a mystery, but not to get too either dogmatic about it or too demanding of it, because, you know, it is a mystery, and what many of the mystics teach about life after death is that people who go to the beyond need to be able to go. They need to be set free. So if we are here craving for our loved ones to come back and be with us, it, in a sense, if there is another side, it could be holding those people back from being free to go to where they need to go. The important thing is, to be small, is we need to inhabit our life fully and worry about the afterlife when we get there. Henry David Thoreau said something very interesting when he was dying, and he died when he was 44 years old. He was a very wise, old, young man. He was asked while he was dying what his thoughts are about the afterlife, and he said, "I worry about one lifetime at a time." So I think the answer to the question I think it's natural and healthy and important for us to remain open, but to keep our feet in this world.
Yes, yes. Now, in all this, I would imagine that love, even self-love, has some important place in one's opinion or understanding of self. Does that figure in your book at all?
Yes, I have a section which I call Learn to Love Vulnerably.
Yeah.
Because when you really look at the mystery of love, for all that the poets and the religions and the philosophers teach about it, one thing we know for sure, it is itself something that's very small. Although we can at times get swept away by it because it's so powerful, love itself needs to be nurtured through small acts every day and requires us to be often very patient, to not be excessively demanding of the ones we love, and to be in a position of serving the ones we love. This requires a kind of humility and a cultivation, a day-to-day smallness. It's like watering a plant every day. Love is that kind of a organic thing. Particularly with the idea of being vulnerable, to really have intimacy with somebody, to really get to know them in their inner places and to invite them into our own inner sanctuary, we need to be vulnerable. We need to tolerate the fact that we don't always know if love will be requited, if it will be returned. We don't know how it will turn out. People do get into conflicts and they do get into fights, and loving somebody doesn't mean that you don't have conflict. So how do you have conflict and work out differences while still loving the person? Well, we need to be very tolerant of our vulnerability, and for that we need to be very small, because our vulnerability can be overwhelming to us. So again, people tend to run away from vulnerability and intimacy. They often get into power trips with the ones they love. Do it my way, or do it this way, or you're wrong, and they set up defenses. Taking these down and just inhabiting our humanity and tolerating the fact that we don't always know the answer, and risking a connection with someone in a moment of vulnerability, really requires an attitude of smallness. So love is very important there. The way of the small is very important there for the art of loving.
Yes. You're really advocating, I believe, the love of others almost before self, although the love of self is clearly also a very important factor.
Well, they go hand in hand. You know, when Jesus, for example, said, love thy neighbor as thyself,
yes,
he was assuming, as a precondition, that you love yourself in order to love your neighbor. Because you see, if we don't love ourselves, and by loving ourselves there, that doesn't—we're not talking about an excessive narcissistic self-aggrandizement, you know, self-preoccupation and selfishness that are so common today in our culture. We're just talking about a basic self-esteem and acceptance of our worthiness, so that we feel that firstly we are lovable and able to receive the love of somebody else, worthy of it, and that we are confident in ourselves enough to then love somebody else.
Yeah.
People who usually can't love and can't receive love don't love themselves.
Right.
And reversely, people who narcissistically love themselves and love only themselves also cannot give love and receive love. So there needs to be a healthy balance.
Yes, I understand what you're saying there. Now, having established clearly that love is important in one's life, do you also, again, having studied the various religions, advise people to use prayer to help themselves along?
Sure. Any of the age-old religious practices that help us slow down, stop in our tracks, and settle into ourselves and pull out what's within us, our own inner resources, our own inner capacities for love and for wisdom. Any of those age-old disciplines are very helpful. Prayer, meditation, contemplation, writing, journaling. Journaling is something that all the mystics and saints whose writings we have did regularly. What we actually have are their journals. Recently, they just published the secret journals of Mother Teresa.
Yeah.
And what everybody got alarmed about was how she struggled, how she had issues around her own faith and doubt about herself and her work. Well, of course, you know, if you're small, you're human, and you're going to have these experiences, and the way to have them is to honor them by some practice like journaling or prayer or meditation.
Right. Mother Teresa, of course, was an exceptional woman. So would you hold her up as an example of how one should act during your life?
Well, she was certainly a master of the small, and I imagine she will be given sainthood if she hasn't already. But as I said, I think she's definitely a wonderful example of being small, you know, how she didn't seek self-gratification in the, you know, traditional, usual ways of our culture, and, you know, gave her life in a full-time effort to help other people.
Yes.
But, again, I to really be small and humble and make a correct assessment of oneself, one needs to ask if that is their way, because not all of us are cut out to be a saint like Mother Teresa.
Yes.
I wouldn't encourage people, if it's not in their nature, if it's not in their unique temperament, to go and live in a convent and work on the streets of Calcutta. There are many ways to give, many ways to make a contribution, many ways to be small. Bill Clinton just wrote a wonderful book called Giving, and he shows that there are many ways to give. I would say to people, read Mother Teresa, read Henry Thoreau, read all the great religious masters,
yeah,
and learn from them what they have to teach about this value of living small, and then make it your own.
Yeah. Giving is really an essential part of one's life. which does make it become a wholesome existence, which I think is one of the expressions used either in your book or one of the reviews that were made of it.
Well, you know, that old adage about giving, when we give to others, we are really also giving to ourselves.
Yeah.
There's no, it's a gift that doesn't stop giving.
In that particular extract that I just quoted, you went on to say, or talk about, the principles of a sound, wholesome existence for both the individual and society. How do you move it on from your individual needs to that of the societies?
That's a very, very important question for the times we live in, because this value of being small has global implications as well as personal ones for everybody. On the individual level, if you look at most of the problems, Mike, that plague us today in the world, chances are they come from our grandiosity. They come from some kind of psychological inflation, wanting to be bigger than we are, wanting to be more involved in other people's affairs than would be productive, doing too much, consuming too much. If we take, for example, we have in the United States now a mortgage crisis, which can send the economy, they're afraid, into a tailspin.
Yeah.
What did that come from? People were very greedy and did not focus on details, the details of what they could afford to buy. That's one of the key principles of living small is celebrate the right details, and they went ahead and bought houses that they couldn't afford, and now we're heading toward all kinds of problems because of that. That's a psychological inflation that happens before the economic inflation. Likewise, here in America, and I think it was the same thing in England, many people felt that going into Iraq in an unprepared way, without planning an occupation, again, not being attentive to the particular details of the region, not giving the other ways of, you know, handling the problem at the time, you know, a chance to really be fully developed, it was a kind of acting too big and too fast, too much too early. And it led into the problems that they've had. If we take perhaps the biggest problem facing the world today, the ecological challenges we have, global warming, climate change, are polluting the oceans and the atmosphere, you know, the problems of you know, depletion of our resources and the extinction of many species. All this is because we're consuming too much, we're polluting too much, we're not being economical in our consumption, we're not thinking in terms of sustainability, of using natural resources. The scientists tell us that we have all the technological means already available to live in a way that does not pollute the earth and increase the temperature of the atmosphere. But what's required is a shift in attitude or thinking before those techniques can be implemented as policies. That shift, really, in thinking, is a shift to thinking small. Until we begin to think small and recognize that we have to live small, none of those changes will happen. So I think that this has a lot of relevance across the board on many, many issues.
Yes. I have a certain sympathy, I think, for people who took out big mortgages, because I believe in the States, as here in England, the banks have been very active in encouraging people to really go beyond their limits.
Well, don't know what will happen there, but here, that kind of grandiosity always comes back and bites you.
Yes.
We're dealing with basic laws of human nature that also exist in physical nature. If you put too much food in your belly and you do it constantly, well, you're going to gain weight.
Yes.
If you put too much air in your tires, well, your car's not going to drive well. And if you put way too much air in your tires, you're going to have a blowout while you're driving.
Yes.
The principle of living small is that it really doesn't require very much to be successful and to find happiness and fulfillment. Marcus Aurelius, the Roman philosopher and statesman, said centuries ago, remember, very little is needed to make a happy life.
Yes.
If we could just accept that and work with that, well, we would simplify our lives, and all these problems, such as you're pointing to, would be managed.
Yes.
They wouldn't even happen.
Right. Can people be small, as you call it, when they are, say, having problems with authorities, whether they be government or otherwise, when they're trying to achieve a decent standard of life? I mean, the laws have changed very much and some have been very draconian. Is there a place for people to enter those conflicts?
Yes, and, you know, here it is important to not, you know, although the way of the small is a simple teaching, it's important to, Einstein once said that make everything as simple as possible, but not more than what's possible, because then you become simplistic or simple-minded. Simplicity and simple-mindedness are not the same. It's important in our negotiating with the social realities in our life, whether it's our job or our boss or some government agency or whomever socially we may be having a conflict with, that we don't get simplistic in our understanding of humility and modesty. Humility and modesty do not mean to lie down and avoid conflict and let yourself be taken advantage of. When Jesus said, if you're slapped on the face, turn the other cheek, that had a very specific meaning in the context of that culture, and it's not exactly what people today think it means. All the teachings in all the religions, including Christianity, teach that although you should be simple and modest, when there's a situation of oppression or injustice, we need to stand up to it. You know, that's why Jesus said, for example, be gentle as a dove, but shrewd or wise as a serpent, so that we have peaceful intentions in our heart, but that we deal with the world, which could be very cunning, on its own terms. So here it's important to be small and strong. They go hand in hand when you look at all the great military generals, and I talk about this in the book, who used the principle of the small in their military strategies. They did it in a very strong and shrewd way, showing very often that little actions can have big results.
Yeah.
So what I talk about in the book is how to deal with conflict and overwhelming odds in small ways that can have great results. Even a David can defeat a Goliath with just a slingshot and good aim.
Yes. Robert Johnson, when he reviewed your book, mentioned that he saw it as one bringing about a balancing of our inner and outer worlds. Do you agree with that conclusion?
Yes, because, the principle of smallness is a principle that cuts across many areas of life, many facets of human experience. It's not just spiritual. It's not just what goes on inside us or when we go to church on Sunday. It's a principle that has economic ramifications. It's a principle that affects our education, how we focus on small teachings and on the details of things so we absorb them. It's a principle that can be applied to politics. It's a principle that has aesthetic implications, how you do your gardening or how you decorate your home. It has a lot of social implications. Urban design or social policies in many areas.
Yes.
The way of the small, the principle of smallness, is it's a principle that can be applied to many areas of life. You see it in science. Nanoscience, nanotechnology are basically disciplines or ways of the small themselves. Genetics, molecular biology. Today, science is really focusing on the small as a way to make great changes. Stem cell research is a very small, you know, it's all done under an electronic microscope, but it has huge implications for healthcare at all levels.
Yeah. Would you say that you have brought out a book that you hope appeals to people who have trouble running their lives? Is that the area that you're targeting?
Certainly one of the areas. Early in the book, I have a chapter called Building a Foundation for Success, and it looks at how the way of the small can help people lead a successful life. That's very appropriate, particularly for young people who are just starting their careers or getting out of college or trying to jumpstart a business. But it's also helpful for people in the middle of life and at the peak of their careers. It deals with issues such as perseverance and attention to details and knowing when to persevere in something and when to quit, knowing when to go with the flow of things but when to go against the flow of things, you know.
Right.
And then toward the later part of the book, I talk about happiness, which I think is relevant to people at all ages. And I even have a section on how to approach old age and the approaching fact of death, that the older we get, there's more behind us and less in front of us. And our lives become smaller as we age. We don't quite have the same energy. We don't have, the same ability to do things. Our children have left home. We have perhaps an empty nest syndrome. We have to deal with diminishment of all kinds.
Yes,
all this is life's way of preparing us for that final diminishment, which is death. And the way of the small can be very helpful in helping us prepare for that, because death is a part of life, too.
Yes. Now, I've exhausted my questions, so what I'd like to ask you, because time is rapidly passing by, it's unbelievable, is there anything you want to add at this stage? And then perhaps you would follow that on by telling people how they could obtain a copy of your book.
Well, sure. I think, perhaps a good way to conclude is just to acknowledge that the world we live in today, with everything going on, is in many ways so excessive and extreme. People don't always understand what's really going on and where all the things that are happening in the world will lead to, all the different wars and conflicts and trends.
Yes.
And we often feel overwhelmed and wonder, what can my little contribution make toward having a good effect? Well, the way of the small, in a sense, pulls us back from all this grandiosity and excessiveness in the world and grounds us within ourselves.
Yes.
You know, this is the paradox of life, that we are living in an age of grandiosity and ourselves want greatness, but that we need to pull back from that and get small and get into our essences to find what's really valuable for us, to find our true worth. So the paradox here is really that, you know, the key to true greatness is through our smallness. That is what will help us lead a meaningful, authentic life. So it's all the more important that we come back to living small so that we can successfully meet the challenges of everyday life in the modern world.
Yes, right. Well, perhaps you could now confirm the title of the book, and as I mentioned, where our listeners could buy a copy.
The book is called The Way of the Small, Why Less is Truly More. You can find it in any bookstore or have your bookstore order it. You could get it from Amazon.com. The book is just out, so it is having a, it's in its beginning, and as Carl Jung said, all beginnings are small, so
I would
very much appreciate people, if they buy a book from Amazon, to feel free to put in a review. It would help get the book out there. You can also get it, I don't know if you have Barnes & Nobles and Borders in England, but they're barnesandnobles.com and borders.com has it. I also have a website. MichaelGellert.com. That's one word, MichaelGellert, MichaelGellert.com. And there's a site in the website for ordering the book that has a connection to Amazon, as well as the publisher,
who is
Nicholas Hayes, Samuel Weiser, Red Wheel. And they do distribute in England, I know that for a fact, and your listeners can order a book through them as well.
Do you, by any chance, send out a newsletter or anything of that nature?
I don't have a newsletter. People can write me if they wish through the website, and if I have an opportunity to, and I will be happy to respond. The website has a number of sub-websites on it with some lectures and talks I've given. So when I give talks, I occasionally post those on the website, and that's a kind of a newsletter.
Yeah. So are you currently involved in workshops or seminars, or are they on your list for the future?
Yes, I do give talks on this topic to organizations. Any organizations that wish to have me come and speak, they can reach me through the website. There's a contact information. I am giving a workshop that is tailored to different groups. One group are Fortune 500 companies and other corporations interested in improving the quality of the work life of their employees, as well as productivity, discovering how small changes can have great effects. I should emphasize that the way of the small is not against affluence or prosperity. It teaches us to size down our attachment and our greed for them. If you can enjoy your affluence and prosperity within natural means, there's nothing wrong with it. The ancients also valued prosperity. Another group who I'm hoping to do workshops with are religious groups, churches, synagogues, different religious organizations. And I give this workshop to social service organizations. That's mental health clinics, agencies that work with the aged, with the dying, with people who have illness, people who are struggling with disabilities. All these diminishing ordeals of life, the way of the small, can be very helpful for.
Yes, yes. An expression that I read in connection with your book, I feel, sums it up very well now that we've had the opportunity to have this interview. And I read that it's been described as provide simple principles to discover true happiness. And I would imagine that's what everybody is looking for.
Yep, that's what I hope people will be able to get from the book.
Yes. Okay. Well, we've actually come virtually to the end of our interview, Michael. I need a minute or two just to close the program and tell our listeners what is happening next week. But it's been very interesting. I hope you haven't revealed everything that's in your book.
No, I've been small about it, so that you got, I hope,
I like
just
that.
What you needed.
Yeah. Well, it's been very nice to have you on the program. Thank you very much. I think that was very successful. And I wish you every success in the near future. Thank you again. I'll leave it at that. And
thank you very much. Thank you very much for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, you're very welcome. Who knows, in the course of the next year, you may even start thinking about writing another book.
Thank you very much for everything.
You're very welcome. Thank you very much, Michael. We'll let you go now.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Now, I have to tell you that next week I shall be a ways, so I imagine what Donald will do is rerun one of the programs that have already been archived. If I can find out which one he's going to use, when I send out my email with details, I'll obviously advise you which one it will be. I will mention that the following Friday, which will be January the 4th, what I thought I would do to start the new year off is have a look at the predictions or prophecies that we will have gained at that point in time for 2008. I thought that might be an interesting start to the new year. Let's have a look and see what everybody's saying should happen. So, it's my last contact with you before your Christmas festivities, so I wish you a very happy and joyful time, and I will thank you for being with me today. Thank you very much. God bless you all.